Call the meeting to order. First off, this is our first meeting, the newly constituted Commerce and Labor Committee for the 2009-2010 session. Welcome to all of our new members. Welcome, of course, to our returning members. We'll do introductions in a moment, but I did want to single out one member, and that is Representative David, who was he doesn't remember this, I do. He was the first committee that I attended as a freshman was this committee, and the chairman of that committee was Greg David. And so I learned everything that I know from Greg David, so if anything goes wrong, blame, to the extent it goes right, you can give me the credit. If anything goes wrong, yeah, and eventually it all comes back to Professor Pender. So, but again, welcome to everybody. We should briefly do introductions, and as long as Representative Sanders is sitting on the far end, if you just want to say where you're from and who you are.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Your favorite color, whatever it is.
My name is Tim Sanders. I represent House District 51A, which is mostly Blaine, and have privately worked in the insurance industry with Fireman's Fund Insurance Company most recently, which is a property casualty company.
Welcome. Representative Murdoch.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Mark Murdoch, and I'm representing District 10B, which is half of Ottawa County, all of Wadena, and a little bit of Becker County up north. And my background is 25 years in retail hardware in with Ace Hardware.
And I have a lot of questions.
So about fixing your house or commerce?
Well, that too, yeah.
Okay. Right. Thank you. It's an honor to be here.
Thank you. Representative Anderson.
I'm Sarah Anderson. I'm from House District 43A. I represent the area of Plymouth and Medicine Lake, and I had the honor of serving with the chair last time as well. So we were reminiscing a little bit of what we did last time. Hopefully we'll have some more fun opportunities this time around too.
I hope so as well, and I'm certain that Representative Hoppe will help us with that. Representative Hoppe?
I'm Representative Hoppe from Janesson and Jaska. I'm new here.
And welcome.
I'm Greg Davis, District 31B, Silmar in Houston County. And Mr. Chairman, when I say it's good to be here, I mean it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Kurt Zellers, District 32B, Maple Grove, and the entire city of Osseo. And after that explanation, now I understand a lot of what happened with you. David was your first committee. this is my fourth term, and fourth term on the Commerce Committee as well.
Ian.
Ian Marsh, Republican Package Research, and I live in St. Paul.
Professor.
I'm Tom Pender from the Health Research Department.
And I'm Anita Newman from the House Research Department.
John Wright, Committee Administrator for the Commerce and Labor Committee, as well as Telecom Regulation and Infrastructure, so I represent John Committee on Friday.
Okay. My name is Joe Atkins, for anybody that I haven't met, but I think I've now met everybody. I represent Invergrove Heights, South St. Paul, and Sunfish Lake. Chris?
Chris Kwapik, Committee Legislative Assistant from Roseville.
Leon Lilly, representing North St. Paul and Maplewood.
I'm the vice chair of our committee. Representative Mullery?
Joe Mullery, representing the north half of North Minneapolis, and I also was introduced to the Commerce Committee under Chair Davis.
Thank you. I'm from over there, and I'm Cy Salas.
And when he says over there, he means over there. It's about 50 feet that way that Representative Dabby.
And we're lucky he doesn't go deer hunting in the local park, because he's tempted.
See what I mean?
Jim Dabby, Best Part of South Minneapolis.
Sheldon Johnson represents Southeast St. Paul.
Patty Fritz, I represent parts of Rice and Steele County from District 26B.
I'm Larry Hosh. I represent Stern County in central Minnesota, just to the west of St. Paul.
Steve Simon, I represent St. Louis Park and Hopkins.
Tom Antels, I represent the west Wasabi Iron Range to Rainy Lake and west to Lake of the Woods.
This is Colton with CSL Research. Everyone calls me Sully.
I didn't even know you had a first name until recently. So, and then we have our two pages.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jeff Mock, Penny Page from Buffalo, Minnesota, and now within Minneapolis.
Hey, I'm Patricia Madison, originally from Tampa, and currently
here. And again, welcome to everybody to the Commerce Committee. Our game plan for the next couple of days, we do have one bill of some urgency that will come before us here very, very quickly. The game plan, though, is we're going to have some of the departments that we visit with quite frequently come and visit with us here and kind of give us an overview of what they're up to. Some of the folks, the various stakeholders that wanted to have a chance to share their concerns and some of their issues that may come before the committee are also going to be given a few minutes as well. And the game plan over the next few days, that is today and Thursday. On Tuesday, we'll start hearing bills. We have a tradition in this committee that we will follow on Tuesday of hearing bills from the minority first. Today's bill is a special exception, so we've declared Representative Mahoney a Republican for a day, so that we can follow our tradition. But I believe Representative Zellers, we may have a bill from Representative Holberg that will be prepared on Tuesday. We'll talk. But and then Thursday we have a joint hearing relative to the Northwest Airlines Delta / MAC discussions with the House Transportation Finance. Transportation Finance, Transportation Policy, as well as the Local Government Committee and our own, to get a sense. So we could pretty much meet on the House floor. I think we've got virtually every member of the House. So in any event, that will be a week from Thursday. And I will try to do that as often as we can in terms of sort of laying out where we're going so that we're not taking anybody by surprise. Very brief overview of what we do. When I first got appointed chair of this committee, everybody, apparently there's these purview statements that come out that say what your jurisdiction is, and I didn't get one for like several days. Every other chair got one, and it began to dawn on me that we really don't have any purview over anything, and they just gave me a gavel to keep me happy. So I asked if I was going to get one, and another couple of days went by, and they assured me that there was one coming. And finally it came, and it's usually a paragraph that says what your committee has jurisdiction with respect to it. Ours was 3.5 pages long. And it goes with everything: insurance, banking, cell phones, cable TV, wireless, mortgages, lending, foreclosure, alcohol, gambling, the lottery, consumer protection, labor, work of a bunch of different departments, anything that impacts business, boxing, and mixed martial arts, among others. So I expect each and every one of you to be an expert on all of those issues by Thursday. But it gives you sort of a sense of the width and breadth of this committee's overview. It's a very exciting committee, but it's also one that requires a significant amount of homework on occasion. As far as rules, I have the same rules that Representative Davids had and Representative Wilkins, who followed him, which is there are no rules. We have the golden rule, which is the chair is always, you just try to do your best by the staff as you can. If you have amendments, if you feel the need to surprise us all with amendments, I guess you can do that, but it makes it hard on everybody, particularly our staff folks. If you can get amendments in as soon as possible, that helps the process along. The only other thing is that, again, we always hear minority bills first, so we will have one on Tuesday. This is an exceptional day with respect to Representative Mahoney's bill, and we will take that up right now. We have Representative Dabney ran, I think, the quickest meeting in House history. Right before we walked in here, and he'll move that the committee report on House File 4 as passed by the Labor and Consumer Protection Division be adopted.
So moved.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that bill is now appropriately before our committee. Representative Dabney, again, if he's comfortable, moves that House File 4 be recommended pass and referred to the House floor. It will then be recommended for re-referral to the House Finance Committee. Representative Mahoney, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's nice to be back.
Nice to have you back. It's been a long time.
I'm Representative Mahoney, and I sat on this committee for 10 years. So it was a delightful committee. Good to leave and move on to other things, but I will miss it, I'm sure. Mr. Chair and committee members, if I could, I would like to put on the amendment on to House File 4. It is the 4A1 amendment.
Representative Dabney moves the amendment to put the bill in the shape that the author wishes to proceed. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion carries. Representative Mahoney.
Mr. Chair, I'll explain the amendment a little bit here. The bill in front of you created a change in the base period for reporting of unemployment. This amendment creates an either-or situation and reinstates the old method of either the first four of the last five completed calendar quarters to this bill, so now you can either do the last four or the first four of the last five, whichever best serves your need to get the unemployment extension. House File 4 is the is a bill that allows for a for more people to get onto the federal unemployment extension, a 33-week extension. As many of you know, and we've all, as all of us know, the state of Minnesota is suffering through, and the nation is suffering through a an upswing in unemployment. We have approximately 200,000 now, projected to be 260,000 by the end of the year. This bill just allows those that are not eligible for the federal extension to become eligible again, or eligible. I can call down Lee Nelson from the Unemployment Division. He can explain a little bit more in depth. I think he lives, breathes, and sleeps unemployment. So if Mr. Nelson would come down and make sure I don't make any serious mistakes.
Thank you, Representative Mahoney. Mr. Nelson.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I am Lee Nelson. I'm the Director of Legal Affairs for the Unemployment Insurance Program in Minnesota. There is one thing I'd like to do, is correct a mistake on your handout here when it's in the last bullet point above the cost of the base period change. The extension will cost approximately $2 million per month, that should be, during the first 3 months. Instead of weeks, those should be months. This bill, we work with Representative Mahoney's office. He, we've spoken with him, and he indicated he wanted to go forward with this bill very quickly, and we worked with his office to do this bill, including including the amendment. The official position of the administration is they're neutral on this bill. But I will again point out we worked very closely with Representative Mahoney in drafting this bill. This bill does two things. It provides a state extension of unemployment benefits to those individuals who do not qualify for the federal extension. The federal extension came in place in July. But because of a certain threshold put in that federal extension, about 10% of unemployed individuals who exhaust the regular state benefits do not qualify for the federal extension. Now, what's an anomaly in Minnesota and why that doesn't occur in most states is because of how Minnesota computes the weekly benefit amount in relation to your whole base period wages. Minnesota pays relatively high benefits in relation to your base period wages. If we in fact paid lower benefits, you would in fact qualify for the federal extension. It isn't that you haven't earned enough total dollars, it's how Minnesota computes that weekly benefit amount. But what this bill does is provide an extension to a state-paid extension for those people who don't qualify for the federal, which is about 10%. We're estimating 3,000 people will qualify immediately upon passage of this bill, and an additional 150 a week. There's currently about 1,500 people a week exhaust regular entitlement, and again, that 10% don't qualify for the federal extension. They would then qualify for this extension. Part of this bill changes the base period, as Representative Mahoney has indicated. If you do that, again, these people who don't qualify for the federal extension have in fact worked long enough. We just don't look at that snapshot in time to measure whether they've earned enough to meet that federal threshold. If you change the period you look at, they will in fact meet the federal threshold, most of them, and they will therefore qualify for the federal extension. So the sooner you change that base period, the sooner people will qualify for that federal extension. We expect that federal extension to be pushed out there further into the future, in fact, for another at least year or more. So the sooner this is done, the more federal dollars which will come into Minnesota and help those individuals who are unemployed. Most of these individuals are some of the lowest paid workers in Minnesota, but again, it's just an anomaly of how we compute the weekly benefit amount that they lose out. We work with Representative Mahoney in drafting this bill. the legislature had done the same thing in 2002 when there was a federal extension. We passed a backfill extension, if you will, to cover this.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Nelson. And I can tell this is the third time I've heard your testimony. One was in Representative Rukavina's committee, and then in Chairman Dabney's committee a few moments ago. I can tell from your testimony now that you've anticipated every question that could possibly be answered. And if, we'll see if anybody can come up with a good one. But Commissioner McElroy had a good comment earlier today, and that was for those 3,000 that are unemployed, it's not that we have a 6.5% or 7% unemployment rate in Minnesota. It's 100% unemployment for them. And for those folks, those 3,000 families that would be impacted by the extension for the period of time that they would be without benefits is a very significant issue. And I'm glad that Representative Mahoney was good enough to bring this forward as rapidly as he has. With that, are there questions or concerns with respect to the bill? Representative Anderson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Nelson, can you remind me again, what kind of impact does this have on the UI fund, and will we see an acceleration of needing to fill that with a special surcharge? I know you talked about that a little bit at the last committee hearing, but can you just remind me again?
Mr. Nelson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, projected payouts from the Unemployment Insurance Fund in 2009 will be about $1.3 billion. This particular extension will cost somewhere between $10 and $15 million. The impact in relation to that $1.3 billion is relatively small, but again, it's a large impact for those who have nothing. And the impact is relatively small in relation to what the total fund is going to pay out. It will not impact employer tax rates, are all set by law. And as a practical matter, they're currently at the highest levels provided by statute, and they will continue to be at the highest levels whether this bill is passed or not for the foreseeable future.
Thank you, Mr. Nelson. Representative Anderson, anything further? Members, any other questions or concerns? If not, Representative Dabney renews his motion that House File 4 be recommended to pass and referred to the House floor with a recommendation that it be re-referred to the
Finance
Committee, and eventually then to Higher Ed Finance. Is that right?
Higher Ed Finance. And
right. All in favor say aye. As amended. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, motion carries. Thank you, Representative Mahoney. Thank you, Mr. Nelson. With that, folks, we have a number of individuals that we've asked join us to provide a sort of an overview of where their departments are. And as well as some of our more frequent visitors before our committee, I would suggest to you that for members that have been on this committee for a while, you may well have heard and seen these nice people before. I'm guessing that some of their issues may well be the same, but in many instances they have new issues that will be coming before us as well. First out of the gate is Commissioner Wilson from the Minnesota Department of Finance. I don't know if that's a promotion or demotion, Commissioner, but from the Department of Commerce, welcome back. It's nice to see you again.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and members. It's a pleasure to be back, and I wanted to start off by saying that we've appreciated very much the good working relationship that we've had with the Commerce Committee in the House. And we'll do everything in our power to extend that and do our very best. I do appreciate the opportunity to come in and visit today very briefly about the department. And an overview of our department is hard to do in a short period of time because it's so broad. But a couple things that I would like to start off with are some of the areas that we're maybe not focused on as often. And I wanted to bring to your attention, first of all, is the weights and measures area. About a year and a half ago, we built a new facility. It's internationally accredited. We do work in numerous other states, but 600 companies in our state are dependent on our calibrating the equipment that they use in their regular line of business. So we do about 600 of those in 39 states all around, and we feel that it's a very important service. Another area is the Petro Fund is in the department, as well as the unclaimed properties. And unclaimed properties, this past year, we had 31,000 claimants, the largest that we've ever had. $18,400,000 was paid out. And over the last few years, we've taken in the from $50 million to over $100 million. We don't have total control over that, in as much as the big numbers came out of the fact that several large mutual companies demutualized a couple years ago, and they were unable to find a lot of the shareholders, beneficiaries, and so forth. So the state benefited from that. But this year we are going to employ two more people to do audits on companies in Minnesota to see if we can find some other areas where unclaimed properties are not being extended to the department. In the market assurance area, which is used to be the enforcement area of the department, it's mostly the area of real estate and banking. The financial area is banking, securities, and insurance. And in that area, we've had several things that I thought that it would be important to report to the committee. In licensing, of course, real estate and mortgage license, real estate license down about 25% this year. Mortgage licenses are down by even more than that, 50% or more. But in the insurance area, in the last 6 years, we've had 112 new companies licensed in the state. But more than that, we've had more than 21,000 new licensees, or more licensees in the insurance area than we had previously. And I think that something that the committee might be interested in as well is, 6 years ago, it was 55% licensees for insurance were in-state, 45% out-of-state. Now that's completely reversed. There's 57% that are out-of-state, 43% in-state. And in looking at it, we think that there's two reasons for that. We have all the license on electronic format now, so that out-of-state licensees find it much easier to license to do business in our state. I think that accounts for a part of it. That and the fact that we have a lot more mobility in our society, both the agents moving out of state wanting to continue their continue to serve their business here, as well as a lot of the consumers moving out of state wanting to stay with an agent here in state. So I thought that was interesting overall. The other area that we have made a significant improvement in, and that's in continuing education. Continuing education for 220,000 licensees in the state has really been a problem. When you consider that there's 850 locations where continuing education can be received, and there's 22,000 courses that have been approved by the department. So when you... I'm not a great mathematician, but when you take 220,000 people, require that they have 10-15 hours of continuing education a year at 850 locations and 22,000 courses, we were trying to do that by hand, and obviously we're doing a lousy job. So we and when we did the automated licensing, we now have automation of the continuing education, so that somebody taking a course in continuing education, the sponsor of the course has 48 hours to post to the internet site in our department the courses and the individual. So it's made a tremendous difference in both the way that we can handle these people and potential employers and others be able to track that. The department also receives about 100,000 calls a year from the consuming public. 25,000 plus of those are calls into the department on insurance. Most of them are inquiries, people that really don't understand the claim, don't understand the policy, and we help them through that. Another area that has significantly grown, which has broadened our contact with the consumers, is our website on a monthly basis is regularly over 100,000 hits. And now there are months when that approaches pretty regularly, close to 200,000 hits. So we think that we're getting more information into the hands of the consumer. certainly in that area, one of the things that you're probably interested in is historically the department has had two to three cases a year where we thought the civil penalty was not enough and we would hand it off for criminal investigation and prosecution. That was two or three cases a year, maybe five people were involved. This year, there's a significant change. And the crimes are more numerous and there's a lot more people engaged. As an example, we have, instead of two cases or three cases a year, we have more than one a week this past year. And where five or six people were involved historically, this year we had over 260. So many of those cases, 15 have been sentenced. We have sentence pending on several cases, and we have numerous cases waiting for prosecution. And we work with a lot of agencies all over the state, local police forces, the IRS, postal department, the FBI, and others. And so we think that we're considerably improving in the fraud detection and work in that area. There's certainly, when we looked at the number of victims, it has gone from several hundred in that category to over 1,600 this year. So we think that we're serving the consumer a lot better and hopefully getting better compliance. In the financial exams area, we have responsibility for the solvency on the insurance companies and the banks, the state banks, some of the local finance companies and credit unions. As well as we try to assure that Minnesota consumers and businesses are protected by the businesses being conducted there and the solvency of those institutions. The vast majority of the state insurance companies, approximately 100 of those and 330 state banks, are in pretty good shape. We're seeing some deterioration in the credit quality, which may lead to some increased problems in the state. I don't think that that's any surprise given the news that we see. And the mortgage industry is facing significant challenges. We're addressing some of those. The fraud in those businesses is much more complex, as I just mentioned, than we anticipated before. But in the 112 insurance companies that are licensed, or the 100 licensed insurance companies within the state, we don't see a whole lot of difference. There are about 10 or 12 historically that have been identified as somebody that we may look at more closely, but that's not like the banking area. Some of them are on that list just because they're large and complex, and a few may be because of marginal solvency, but by and large, the state has benefited in the past 10 years of not having lost a bank and or an insurance company. On the banking side, it's a little bit different in as much as the outstate banks are a little bit stronger than they had been historically, but with the volatility in commodities, we're seeing some outstate banks under stress after a couple great years in the outstate economy. In the suburban areas, the Twin Cities, it's a different story. Those banks, the state banks, traditionally find a good place to place money is in the real estate development and construction loan. Of course, that is under considerable stress. And the number of banks that are on our watch list in Category 3, 4, and 5 has significantly increased in the past several years, or particularly this past year. With that, Mr. Chairman, we also have the energy telecom pipeline and so forth that the committee's not interested in, and so I pass on that.
I was going to say, Commissioner, we didn't expect you to be necessarily the be-all, end-all at this meeting. We fully expect you'll be back, or your very capable staff will join us as issues come before the committee. But I deeply want to appreciate or tell you how much we appreciate your efforts, and it's kind of a sad testament with the number of fraud offenses that you guys have gone after has jumped so dramatically
But I can tell you from firsthand discussions with law enforcement how much they appreciate the expertise that you guys bring to that, that many of the local departments, smaller departments, don't have. And have heard directly from some of those folks that have worked with your people how much they appreciate it. But are there, with the understanding that we'll have the department folks back, are there questions or concerns for Commissioner Wilson today? Representative Davis?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner Wilson, one thing that we've talked about previously is the new SEC ruling that takes indexed annuities out of state jurisdiction and puts them under the SEC, the same SEC that brought us Enron, Lehman Brothers, Bear Stearns, and Bernie Madoff. I'm very concerned. Fixed indexed annuities are not a security product. They have a guarantee. They're not invested in the markets. Directly invest in the markets, and so they should be a fixed contract. And my real concern is, so that's one concern. The other concern is, with the SEC taking these over, at what point do we lose the premium tax and everything goes to the SEC and the state of Minnesota gets nothing? I would much rather have you go after any bad actors than the SEC who can't handle what they're doing now.
And Commissioner Wilson, if it helps your answer at all, I agree with Representative David. So go ahead.
Chairman and Representative David. Well, first of all, it's a greater problem, and I think for this committee and our state than what you described. In as much, and I'll answer the question, but the optional federal charter is a serious major threat to this state. It's not just in that particular area. But to answer your question, we're also fortunate in our state that we have securities and banking and insurance in the same department. So suitability, for the most part, is uniformly applied across all three disciplines. From that perspective, we don't see much difference in the way that we treat or handle that. They want to have uniform, most states have different departments, and so they want to have uniform area of regulations. I don't think that, frankly, it'll affect our state as much. But in terms of the premium tax and the threat of moving the whole regulatory scheme to Washington is, in my opinion, a very, very serious threat.
I think you got the right answer, didn't you, Representative
David? Very, very good answer.
We kind of knew that was going to be your answer, too, Commissioner. Thank you very much. Are there any other questions at this time? All right. Thanks again.
Thanks.
See you back here soon. We are now, we've got the pleasure of being joined by former representative, former speaker, now commissioner, Steve Sagan. You going to work your way around the table and hug everybody, or are you just doing
You are first.
Welcome back. And actually, I'll forewarn you, I just did the math, commissioner, and I've realized that if everybody talks for about the time we have calculated, we'll be out by 6, and we won't be back on Thursday. And so we actually have the opportunity to give people the afternoon off on Thursday, depending on how long you talk.
That's just 5 minutes?
Mr. Speaker, you can have as much time as you want.
Something like 10 or 15 minutes.
That would be, actually, that would, and we have about a half dozen folks at 3 minutes apiece after that. So you got 10, 15.
I'm trying to add 6 times 3.
Yeah, I don't. If that'll take too long.
Mr. Chairman, members, thank you very much for giving me an opportunity to give you an overview of the Department of Labor and Industry, a wonderful group of purpose individuals who are very performance-orientated, about 490 souls who, whose mission is to protect the workplace, the living quarters, the jobs of the citizens of Minnesota. And, Mr. Chairman, I'm very, very impressed with the quality of the individuals, the employees we have working at DLI. They really are performance goal oriented. Let me give you just a couple of examples. A couple of examples over the past year. I've been in Representative Fritz's district. I think you were with us, Representative Fritz, down at the correctional facility where we had a very large employer do construction work on the Fairville Correctional Facility, which you voted for in the bonding bill, I think in 2006. And did this significant amount of work without a lost day, without one reportable injury on this site doing construction work. Very, very significant amount of work that was done in conjunction with our consultation OSHA department and certainly the safety resources of the company itself.
I've been in areas of the state where we've seen a misuse of our child labor, and we've seen citations given to businesses who have hired 15-year-olds before 7 o'clock in the morning. As you know, I think we have a rule that says that on school nights cannot be hired before 7 o'clock in the morning or can't be working at that time. I've seen businesses being cited for the misuse of child labor at facilities that serve liquor and 14-year-olds working in that facility against the law. And our folks have been out in force and investigated those situations. We've tried to bring forward in an impartial way a very fair balance between the safety and both the job site, the workplace, and the homes in the city. We basically have, Mr. Chairman, members of five different units in the Department of Labor and Industry, if I can real quickly go through them. First of all is the Workers' Compensation Unit. It's a unit of some 90 employees, about $183 million for the biennium. The Workers' Compensation Unit does everything from dispute resolution, where I've set in dispute resolutions, where we try to bring folks who have a dispute in the workers' compensation system together without the necessity of legal litigation lawyers being present.
What?
I thought I'd get to your attention. No, Mr. Chairman, one lawyer was the president on one side, but we're bringing people together in this dispute resolution. Workers' compensation also, through the department, handles all the supplementary benefits and the second injury fund benefits for individuals who were awarded those benefits previous to 1995 when they were no longer provided by this Workers' Comp Reform Bill of 1995. Secondly, we have our OSHA department. A department whose mission is very, very simple. And the simple mission, trying to be not a complicated person, is that everybody gets home at night the same way they go to work in the morning. They go home at night that same way they go to work in the morning. The department has 99 employees. That unit, excuse me, has 99 employees and about a $24 million budget. The third unit is our Construction Code and Licensing Division. It's called the CCLD. It does all the permitting. It does all the licensing of various trades in the state, the high-pressure piping, the electrical, the plumbing licenses in the state, contractors' licenses, and, of course, now the new independent contractor exemption certificate, the law that was passed. I think, Representative Mulroy, you had some influence in that, and Representative Atkins certainly did. Representative Rukavina did with the law that was passed in 2007. We are now licensing with exemption certificates, independent contractors in the state. Very honestly, we are licensing far less individuals than we had anticipated. As of today, only 600 independent contractor exemption certificates have been issued within the state. But there's about 163 employees there with a total budget of $65 million. The fourth unit is the Labor Standards Unit in Apprenticeship Division. That is a unit run by Roslyn Wade, approximately 12.5 people that are in labor standards and 6.5 people in the apprenticeship program. It is the only unit that the Department of Labor and Industry gets general fund money for. We get approximately between $900,000 and $1 million for our Labor Standards Unit. That's the unit that investigates everything from child labor laws to minimum wage concerns to prevailing wage concerns. That unit, again, is the only unit that does get general fund money. All the other monies within our department, some $250 million, either comes from federal dollars or from fees on licenses, fees on contractors, or obviously we do have some penalty monies that do come forward as well. And then lastly, our General Support Division is a division which supports all those other five divisions, and that is IT, legal services, we have financial services, we have communication, we have research. And statistics within the General Support Services, 118 employees there with $23 million. Our overall goal, our overall mission is the safety of the workplace, safety of the home setting,
the safety of the job site for individuals in the state, and we've had some really, really good people out there working for you and working for the citizens of the state to make sure that mission takes place. Mr. Chairman,
You still got like 7 minutes left. Are you...
Can I just very quickly then just tell you a couple of concerns? I did mention the independent contractor concern, of which I'm sure most of you are interested in. And some of you have probably received some letters, both pro and con, some questions about what the state is doing here, asking for $150 for a license for an independent contractor. As you all know, it was a result of a legislative auditor report in 2007, stating there were some concerns about misclassification of employees and then questions about unemployment, workers' comp, and taxes being paid. There are far less applications coming forward than we anticipated. Secondly, we are trying very, very hard within our division to bring forward to you a workers' compensation reform bill this year that is significant. We are getting very, very close. Our Workers' Compensation Advisory Council, which by law is 6 members of business, 6 members of labor, meets on January 28th. We've had a number of committee meetings of stakeholders over the summer trying to get them together and find significant common ground on a reform bill, which is very, very important to the state in workers' compensation. I am very, very hopeful at this time that on January 29th, I will be able to come to you, Mr. Chairman, and say that we have an agreement within the WCAC, and we will forward a very significant reform bill that will both save money and that will probably save some premiums and enhance some benefits in the state. We're trying to focus that bill on our two most important stakeholders. Those are injured workers and businesses that pay the premium. Now, you all know that there are tens of other stakeholders in the workers' comp area. You will hear from some of them. Let me forewarn you. But focus, if you will, always back to the two most important stakeholders, the injured worker and the business that pays the premium. If you can do that, I think you will see a very a positive reform bill come from the WCAC. And then lastly, prevailing wage. I know, Mr. Chairman, is always of interest to this committee and to this legislature. We have done investigation. We have done enforcement. You did give us 3 additional people last year. They were hired within the prevailing wage enforcement investigation. Just let me tell you, I believe that they are doing their job and doing it well. So now I'll take the question.
All right. Well, now we're at 3 minutes. But what do you attribute the lower number of independent contractor apps to?
I will try to rationalize many, many different things. It could be, first of all, there may not have been as many tens of thousands of independent contractors out there as we had anticipated. I don't know that to be true, but Mr. Chairman, within our department, we took a little pool this summer as to how many contractor exemption certificates we would be issuing, and my number was 17,800. We've now issued 600, so I'm a little bit off. but I was low in the department. I was low number, so I still might win the pool. So there might not have been as many as we anticipated. Secondly, Mr. Chairman, we have seen an increase with the Secretary of State's office in the number of LLCs that have been formed within the state. We do think, without any knowledge, that there might be some folks legitimately that were independent contractors might be moving to formation of LLCs. Thirdly, I don't need to tell this committee, and all of you have been out on the campaign trail for the last 6 months, I don't need to tell you that there's a little lack of construction activity around the state of Minnesota. And with the lack of construction activity that there is, it's very, very probable that a lot of the independent contractors are not working right now. There's just no work out there. So it's very, very possible that the need for the licensure is not there. And then I suppose fourthly and lastly, maybe make a little Minnesota winter, 17 degrees below zero this morning. There are some persons who are probably seeing that they're not going to need a certificate until, you know, April, May, something of that nature. I think we maybe need to give it a little bit more time to
make some type of a reasonable analysis as to why. But those would be four reasons, and I'm sure there's others.
Still doesn't sound like it's going to make a run towards your 17,000 number, but we'll see. You only have a shot at that pool yet. Are there other questions for Commissioner Spiegel? All right. Well, thank you very much, and thank you for the work that you and your department do.
Thank you.
We have a number of folks that come before this committee with some regularity, and we wanted to give them an opportunity. Either they come here or they invade your offices anyway, so we thought we'd give them a chance to come and visit briefly. And I know that Mr. Johnson, I believe, has another appointment that he's gonna bail out on me if we don't hear from him. So with due deference to the other nice folks that are in front of him, Mr. Johnson, you got a minute for us and give us an overview of what sort of issues you might have coming before us, or what you anticipate we might see on this session?
No, thank you, Mr. Chairman, for doing that. You didn't need to, but I appreciate that.
Well, the other ones are probably going to yell at me, so we'll see, but they're a pretty fair bunch.
Mr. Chairman, I don't yell, and I've been here too many years to start, so I'm not going to do that. But a one-page handout, Mr. Chairman, Bob Johnson, Insurance Federation of Minnesota, and I'll be coming to the committee, Mr. Chairman and committee members, on all property casualty lines and health insurance, so the bills in those areas, and what you're receiving here, Mr. Chairman and committee members, is just a one-page hint that flags some key statistics that I thought I'd take 90 seconds on and just go over for the committee, and it flags two areas, Mr. Chairman, that I'd at least like to put on the table in a subsequent date, maybe have some conversations. One is that how much it costs to insure a car on average in Minnesota for a year. So that's the first number, $793. The second number is how much it costs on average to insure a home by a homeowner's policy in Minnesota, $790. The third number is $600,000, and $600,000 is the estimate that our industry puts on how many cars are on the streets and highways of Minnesota driving without car insurance, $600,000. The fourth number, $1,000, is the estimated impact of every family in the state of Minnesota, the cost of insurance fraud. And then I just listed two issues underneath that: insurance fraud and uninsured motorists. And Mr. Chairman and committee members, I just think on a going forward basis and at a subsequent hearings, and we'll have opportunities to talk, but I think the committee should be aware that insurance fraud and uninsured motorists are issues that are getting a lot of attention around the country. So a lot of states are looking at trying to combat and deal with both these issues. There's a national study coming out before the end of the week, Mr. Chairman, that's going to studies and gives the uninsured motorist rate per state, and actually the study is projecting that there's an expectation of the uninsured number to increase significantly in America with the current economic conditions. The study says that for every 1% increase in unemployment rate, there is a 0.75% increase in the number of uninsured cars in a state. There's another study that tracks with the increase in premiums how many cars become uninsured. That's a California study. So I think from the industry's perspective, Mr. Chairman and committee members, there are things that we can do and be looking at to deal with both these issues. We look forward to working with you, Mr. Chairman, and the committee members about these two. They're significant. They're things we can do. They're worth, I think, our time from a public policy perspective, and we just look forward to this session. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. We appreciate your time today. Next up is Pat Martin from the Minnesota Mortgage Association. By the way, can you tell that Mr. Johnson's been around a little while? He knows that legislators like everything on a single page, so that's what we prefer to read. Mr. Martin, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Pat Martin, and I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Mortgage Association. We'll have a chance, I'm sure, this session to talk about a number of issues relating to mortgages, including credit availability, foreclosure, lending issues. But one thing that I did need to get onto the radar screen is a result of the federal law that passed over the summertime. Congress passed the Housing and Economic Recovery Act of 2008, and this is going to require the state to make some changes in the way it licenses its mortgage lenders. And we're working in concert with the Department of Commerce right now to try and figure out all the things that we need to do. some of the obvious things that we'll need to do, for example, is to increase the number of pre-licensing hours for individuals from the current state law 15 to 20. We'll have a continuing education requirement that will have to be in the law. And we are threatened by the HUD warriors. If we don't do this, they will come here and take over our licensing system. This will be a federally mandated system. So we're going to have a few things that we have to pay attention to. And I'm sure that once the dust settles a little bit on this, HUD's still issuing interpretive letters, and once the dust settles, we'll have a chance to figure out exactly what's best for the citizens of the state of Minnesota. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Martin. We appreciate you joining us here. We also appreciate you letting Mr. Johnson go ahead of you. It's very kind of you. Ms. Rowan from the Minnesota Insurance and Financial Services Council is another one of our frequent flyers before this committee. You'll see a lot of her as well as some of the others. Ms. Rowan, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you. Can I trade in miles for something? We can fly a reward program. Or?
You can have part of the deficit if you'd like. No? All right.
Yeah, thank you. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Robin Rowan. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Insurance and Financial Services Council, or MIFSI. MIFSI members provide financial security for all stages of a consumer's life through sales of life insurance, long-term care insurance, retirement plans, annuities, and other financial products. We formed MIFSI just a little bit over a year ago because Minnesota's life insurance industry wanted to have a more distinct voice at the Capitol given the strength of the industry here in Minnesota. We provide over 20,000 high-paying jobs in addition to thousands of agents that sell our products throughout the state. Should have in front of you one page with a list of our members and a little bit about us, but our members range from the four big employers in the metro area, Securian in St. Paul, Allianz in Golden Valley, Thrivent and Ameriprise in downtown Minneapolis, to small not-for-profit fraternals like Sons of Norway and Degree of Honor. In terms of issues, we'll have a proposal this session to protect the vital role of life insurance from speculators who want to use it solely as a vehicle to wager on the lives of seniors. It's something that you might have heard referred to as STOLI, or Stranger Originated Life Insurance. So I thank you for the opportunity to speak before you, and I very much looking forward to working with you this session.
Thank you, Ms. Rowan. We appreciate your time this afternoon. Next up is Bernie Hess from the United Food and Commercial, United Commercial and Food Workers, they have you down as. Now, they changed your name.
The union.
Welcome back.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for this time. I know brevity is appreciated. My name is Bernie S. I'm with Local 789 of the United Food and Commercial Workers Union. We represent workers in meatpacking, retail, and long-term care. And the reason I'm coming to your committee today is kind of a setup so we can have a discussion this session. Commissioner Smigham talked about some of the recommendations that he's going to make to the legislature for changes in the worker comp system. One thing that we flagged upon receiving some of these recommendations, and I would ask that you listen to this, and I'll walk you through our concerns. One of their legislative recommendations is an illegal worker who sustains a workplace injury shall receive only medical care and service benefits provided by the employer for the treatment of the injury sustained. And what this means is if there's a worker in a plant that is undocumented, and we don't refer to workers as illegal aliens, I don't think any, and I'm not the most politically correct person, but to us, you know, all humans should be regarded, and nobody's illegal, but their status might be muddled at times. But by implementing this thing where if you're an undocumented worker and you're injured and the company's responsibility is only to provide medical services for that injury and then they're excused from any other things within the worker comp system, we find is counterproductive to good business. And we believe the opposite would actually occur, that while the majority of companies are honest and compliant, and I can tell you that I have really worked with a number of companies in regards to when they're reviewing and
checking people and hiring and verifying their immigration status, there are a number of companies who would intentionally use this to lower costs and create an uneven playing field. It's almost like an economic incentive. So we would ask that when these recommendations come up, that you stay away from this. I have seen too many workers over the years injured, and because they're newly arrived or their status is somewhat muddled, they just kind of fade away into the shadows. And I'll give you a story real quickly. Last spring, I had a worker evolve his hand in one of our plants. And one of the first questions I asked when we were investigating this is, was the worker properly documented? And he was. But otherwise, I have fears that if this young man had not been all his documents in place, he would have just kind of faded away without getting the services and things through worker comp. I just want to give you an example, and then I'll end. Under the National Labor Relations Act that my union is guided by, we're obligated to represent workers regardless of their immigration status. And I would ask that businesses also have that obligation to properly care for workers. So please, you know, there'll be a much discussion about the recommendations. But I think this is a bad policy primarily for workers, but also a bad policy for businesses in Minnesota. It creates an unlevel playing field. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hess. Next up on our list is Scott Lambert and Alyssa Schlander from Minnesota Auto Dealers Association. While they're coming up, we had Jennifer Breitinger on our calendar this afternoon. She called and was unable to make it, but I'm sure we'll see plenty of her over the course of the session. Ms. Schlander, Mr. Lambert, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Off the record, I'm Scott Lambert with the Minnesota Auto Dealers Association.
And I'm Alyssa Schlander, Minnesota Auto Dealers Association.
Mr. Chairman, thank you for your time. We don't have a specific issue to talk about today, but there's been so much said and written about the auto industry in the last few months, we thought we would come by and give you sort of a bird's eye view of what's going on in our industry and sort of how we see what's happened and what may happen in the future. Mr. Chairman, for the past 5 years prior to the September, the events in the financial market in September, the Minnesota retail car industry was contracting and consolidating, and we felt we were at the kind of the tip of the spear of this recession. We saw it coming, and we knew we were in one. We were not growing. In fact, our market prior to September of 08 was down 20-25%. We had lost close to 60 dealers at that point, and it was orderly. It was unfortunate, but it was an orderly transition over time. As markets changed, as buying habits changed, as General Motors' market share dropped from the mid-30s to the high teens, as we saw the rise of more people buying international brands. They're all our members. We love them all. But it created a dramatic shift in the way our business is conducted. We saw Lincoln Mercury's folding into Ford's. We saw Dodge's folding into Chrysler's. That was sort of natural, and it was all market-oriented. And it was too bad, but we thought we were as prepared as any industry for a major recession. The events of September really caught everybody off guard, and I don't know that I'm going to have words to describe just how bad this is right now. Since September, our sales have plummeted, and each successive month's numbers have been worse than the month before. And I don't know where the bottom of this is right now. The collapse of the financial markets in mid-September had three big consequences to us. First of all, it led to a complete collapse of consumer confidence. And they are simply not showing up in droves. Ms. Schlander will go over some numbers here in a minute. But, for instance, Chrysler is down 53% over the previous December of last year. And last December was a terrible month. So that just gives you a taste of where we're going with this. Consumer confidence destruction has been terrible for our business. The other big problem is that we're suddenly, and it's almost unthinkable, looking at the insolvency of major domestic manufacturers. This was a tremendous concern to us, because if they do go insolvent, we lose our franchise protections that are in Minnesota law, and all 50 states have similar laws protecting dealers from the manufacturers. But in the event of a Chapter 11 or a Chapter 7 bankruptcy,
they would, a bankruptcy judge would not recognize those, and we would be left to the vagaries of manufacturers and the bankruptcy judge. So the solvency of the manufacturers, besides all the calamity it would cause, was of unique concern to us. Finally, Mr. Chairman, what was my third thing? Well, we had the final thing is the collapse of the markets as a whole and the financial markets. Manufacturers don't sell cars to consumers. Manufacturers sell cars to dealers. Dealers have to go get financing to make that happen. We call that floor planning. And while financing is very available to consumers right now, it is not, and that remains so before the crisis and after the crisis hit. Financing for dealers can run as high as $3 million for your average dealership. That's been very difficult to get, and there's been a scramble. It's sort of below the radar. It's not something you read about, but with GMAC and Chrysler Credit and the captive finance agencies dominating this business for decades, 75% of the business was done by Ford Credit, Chrysler Credit, and GMAC. GMAC and Chrysler Credit got swept up in the subprime mortgage mess that has consumed the financial markets. So they lost money there. Then they lost their ability to sell their commercial paper. Those markets left them. They had to make it up somewhere. Their response was to come make it up on the dealers' backs. And they started hitting the dealers with terms and conditions that were unseen or unheard of in previous years. And in some cases, they felt they were overextended and just started denying credit. With a lack of a banking experience, the dealers have been scrambling to try and find this kind of complicated and unique financing to our business. So that's sort of ongoing, and we're still dealing with this. I don't think we have a great solution to it right now. We are working with the Minnesota Bankers Association trying to get some new players into the market, but it remains a genuine and kind of unique concern for our business. So, Mr. Chairman, I'll let Ms. Shalander go over some specific numbers, but we are very concerned about the future. I don't think I have words to describe the market we're in right now. It is bad and getting worse, and I hope we can find our way out of it. I'd love to say we're going to solve the deficit for the state, but I just don't think it's going to happen from our industry, and we're hoping we can save more dealers before the year's out.
Thank you. Ms. Schwinder.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you for giving us the opportunity. I'll try to just add to what Mr. Lambert said and try not to reiterate. As you said, the global credit crisis in the last quarter of 2008 really escalated the failures on the retail end of our industry. Vehicle sales in Minnesota were down 18% from last year. That's the lowest that they've been since 1992. Most industry analysts are expecting 2009 numbers to be at their lowest point in the last 26 years, so there really is no end in sight to this downturn in our industry. Sales numbers have gotten worse, as Mr. Lambert said, every single month since the credit crisis happened in September. And they have gotten worse in across all manufacturers. Chrysler was down 53% in December, Toyota down 37%, Honda 35%, Ford 32%, and GM 31%. That's December 2008 compared to December 2007. As Scott said earlier, December 2007 wasn't exactly a banner year for the industry, so that kind of tells you where we're at. All those numbers really add up to the fact that Minnesota's auto sales are down by $2.2 billion in 2008. We have closed 40 new car dealerships in 2008, and that is approximately 1,800 jobs just in our industry alone. So as you go forward this year and start to consider the legislation that will come before the Commerce Committee dealing with financing and franchise and product regulation and just general retail issues in general, I would encourage you to consider the state of the industry right now. As we said, we don't really foresee any big initiatives that we'll be trying to advance this year, but we will be most concerned with how legislation will either help or hurt our ability to sell cars. Thank you.
Thank you both. Next up is Mara Humphrey from the Minnesota Credit Union Network. And then our final visitor this evening is Dominic Esposito from the Independent Insurance Agents. So I think I can safely say we're not going to meet on Thursday. Representative, I think people kind of like that. You all are welcome to come, but Murdoch, you should be here. I think as a freshman, there'll be a lot of hardware questions on Thursday. So. Oh, yeah. He's going to chair the freshman contingent. Ms. Humphrey, welcome back to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Mara Humphrey. I'm Vice President of Governmental Affairs for the Minnesota Credit Union Network, and I appreciate the moment just to introduce myself and tell you a little bit about the organization I represent. The Minnesota Credit Union Network represents the state's 159 credit unions and the state's 1.5 million credit union members. And we have around 4,300 employees statewide, and our credit unions are based roughly half and half in the metro area and in greater Minnesota. And credit unions are not-for-profit cooperatives, and as cooperatives, they return their profits to members in the form of fewer fees for service, lower interest rates on loans, higher returns on savings, and improved services to members. And as many other industries right now, credit unions are also seeing the effects of the downturn in the economy. Fortunately, for the most part, credit unions are safe, sound, and secure. They do not participate in a lot of the risky loans. So, by and large, credit unions are doing very well, weathering the storm. We're ready to lend, make some car loans. Hopefully, we can keep the auto dealers afloat and help make some loans on those cars. So, we are seeing some of the impact, though, of the downturn. I think it's a downturn. It's a cyclical cycle, and it's a tough time right now for a lot of people. And one of the areas we were happy to work with this committee last session is the passage of the 11 bills on addressing foreclosure, and I think that helped a lot, but I'm sure that there's going to be a lot more work to do, so I look forward to working with this committee and meeting with each one of the committee members and talking more in depth on issues as they rise.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm glad to see that you're framing your message. I see it on the billboard every day when I drive up here. Safe, sound, and secure. So,
Mr. Chair, glad to hear.
Thanks again. And Mr. Esposito. Always a rousing finish, the crescendo. Are you going to speak in Italian? You did that last time for us, if you wish. Save it for the end.
All right.
It's kind of a...
Mr. Chairman, I'm Dominic Esposito. I represent two of the largest insurance agents groups in the state, the Independent Insurance Agents of Minnesota, which are your Main Street property and casualty agents. They sell things like homeowners, auto insurance, commercial liability, workers' compensation. I also represent the National Association of Insurance and Financial Advisors, which is a state organization that represents mostly life insurance agents, and they sell things like life insurance, annuities, long-term care insurance, disability policies. We are very, very interested in the dealings of this committee because it affects all the insurance agents in the state, which are regulated by the state and subject to the laws that you make. And one of the things we're really interested in is making sure that continues. The commissioner mentioned the efforts for an optional federal charter and also proposals for federal regulation of the insurance industry. And we're very concerned about that. And one of the things we're trying to do to stave that off is to try and build a platform of regulation of insurance professionals, insurance agents, that is consistent throughout the rest of the country so that we can show Congress and others that states can regulate people and make it work. One of the things we're working on with the department is a major licensing initiative to change the licensing of insurance agents. We're going to do things to make it more compatible with other states, and I know this is going to excite Representative Davids, but we're talking about lowering the number required continuing education hours from 30 to 24, because 24 is the norm in the rest of the country. We want to make sure that when we do that, we're not dumbing it down, if you will, but that we're doing it appropriately. We also want to be able to license agents throughout the year instead of one time. Right now, all agents' licenses are due in October. There are some 90,000 licenses that go through the state, and even though we are on an online system, it's still very, very time-consuming, so we're going to propose having the agents license be contemporaneous with their birth date so that it will be spread out throughout the whole year. That's a major change in how we do it, and I think it's going to be very interesting. The second issue that the life agents are very interested in is, again, the STOLE issue, protecting people from wagering on human life. I know you're going to hear more about that in the future. I just want you to know it's a very, very hot topic in the life insurance industry, and insurance professionals are very concerned about the effect that that could have on traditional life insurance, which we think is a very valuable product. So thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I'm very pleased that you all stuck around just for me. Thank you.
And we did. They sent a note around saying, Mr. Spizzetto's up last. Everybody wants to stay. So thank you very much, Mr. Spizzetto. Thank you to all those that joined us this afternoon. Welcome aboard to all our new members, and welcome back to all our returning members. Again, there is no meeting on Thursday. We will do our best to get out plenty of notices to the bills that will be coming before us on Tuesday. And then keep in mind that next Thursday will be a joint hearing. We'll get notice out of that. That will not be in this room. I believe it will be in room 200.
Or
the Capitol, or perhaps on the front lawn if the weather's nice. All right, thank you all. We stand adjourned.